If you live or work in New Jersey, you likely see polluted sites all the time without even knowing it. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. There are thousands of them across the Garden State, and since 2009, private sector contractors have been doing much of the cleanup. As part of our Dirty Little Secrets series, WHYY's Joe Hernandez took a look at how outsourcing toxic site cleanup is working in New Jersey.
On Princeton Avenue in Maple Shade, Burlington County, just off busy Route 73, a few residents who live around the corner from a contaminated gas station had no idea it was leaking into the soil and groundwater.
Well, I thought, you know, that they were checking something, but then it was like, I said to my husband, like, how long does it take? That's been up there a couple years. Why is that? They forgot to take the sign down, I thought.
Well, I'm just surprised. I didn't know. Maybe that's why none of my flowers ever grow.
I don't know what they've done, you know what I mean? So I don't know if the company's cleaning it up or if the state's cleaning it up. That I'm not sure either, but, you know, I mean, they're trying to clean it up, so I guess that's good.
That was Beverly Schrenk, Bob Richards, and Kimberly Crean. And their confusion is understandable. Records show contamination at the gas station goes back as far as 1995. But cleanup is starting to pick up in Maple Shade and at toxic sites all across New Jersey, thanks to a state law known as the Site Remediation Reform Act. It was passed in 2009, not long after the Department of Environmental Protection, or DEP, got hit with a series of big staff and funding cuts.
It just became very, very difficult for the existing staff to manage the amount of cases that were coming through the department.
Mark Mariello was DEP commissioner in 2009. He says that having a small staff responsible for such a heavy workload, about 20,000 cases, meant that contaminated sites were getting cleaned up very slowly.
Which is not good environmentally, and it's not good for communities, and it's not good for the property owners who are trying to get these sites back into productive use.
Cue the Site Remediation Reform Act, which did several things. The biggest one, though, was turning over authority of the cleanups at most sites to the private sector. DEP case managers used to do that work themselves, but now the department would license environmental professionals to oversee toxic site cleanups and be responsible for the outcome. They're called Licensed Site Remediation Professionals, or LSRPs. At that gas station in Maple Shade, the LSRP is Philip Brilliant, who owns the firm Brilliant Environmental Services.
Yeah, I was born with that. It's a great marketing name, I'll tell you that much.
When I caught up with Brilliant at the gas station, he and a handful of workers were trying to figure out how badly some leaked gasoline had polluted the groundwater.
And as we walk over, you'll see some little concrete patches on the asphalt, and these are monitoring wells. We go to the first groundwater where we encounter groundwater, we set the well, and we're looking for gasoline, which is a floater.
As the LSRP for this gas station, Brilliant is responsible for directing the entire cleanup. He did a historical investigation of the site, tested the soil and groundwater, and will devise a plan to clean it all up. Brilliant, who had previously worked alongside the DEP as a consultant, says now LSRPs can make decisions about their sites and perform cleanups without asking permission first.
You're not waiting for somebody at DEP to pick a report up from a file cabinet and take a look at it and come back to you with responses.
The DEP says the LSRP program has been a total success. When it started, there were more than 20,000 sites in the state's toxic cleanup program. Now there are about 14,000. In 2014, for the first time, the DEP closed more toxic cleanup cases than it opened. But privatizing toxic site cleanup doesn't sit well with everyone.
And you created essentially an entire shadow arm of state government that was not only responsible to the DEP, but also responsible to their clients, the very companies that had created the pollution in the first place.
Doug O'Malley runs the group Environment New Jersey. He says there's a conflict of interest when the LSRPs are being paid by the same property owners who they're supposed to be holding accountable for a thorough cleanup. He also says LSRPs had too much influence over creating the law that created them.
You essentially have an insider club, and they have successfully worked to, you know, weaken standards and make it easier so that they wouldn't get in trouble.
But the DEP says it still holds sway over these private professionals. An independent licensing board vets each potential LSRP. That board then audits 10% of LSRPs every year and levies penalties if they break the rules. Last month, for the first time ever, the board voted to suspend an LSRP's license. Proponents say this proves the program works, that penalties for doing a shoddy job and the knowledge that they bear the ultimate responsibility for a cleanup means LSRPs won't try to game the system. To illustrate that point, DEP Assistant Commissioner Mark Peterson described a reaction one woman had at a meeting with a group of LSRPs.
And I said, okay, so tell me, how's it working for you? And she looked at me panicked. First thing out of her mouth was, I can't sleep at night.
Peterson says that shows how seriously they're taking the job. In fact, he says that out of the nearly 7,000 cases closed in the program, LSRPs have withdrawn only about 2 or 3%. What remains to be seen is whether that number grows or shrinks as the program gets older. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
And we'd like to hear from you as we continue to report on New Jersey's toxic legacy. Pass along your questions about contamination or pollution in South Jersey by visiting newsworks.org/dirtylittlesecrets. Philadelphia's 99th mayor, Jim Kenney, will be inaugurated into office Monday, January 4th. And in advance of that transition, NewsWorks Tonight is looking at the legacy of outgoing mayor Michael Nutter. In this evening's fourth installment of a seven-part series, let's take up taxation with Robert Inman, professor of finance at Wharton and a recent member of the mayor's task force on tax policy. Also, Holly Otterbein. She's written extensively about Philadelphia's tax structure, first for us and now for Philadelphia Magazine's Citified blog. Holly, Bob, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Professor, how about a history lesson to start? Take us all the way back to the Sterling Act of 1939.
Well, I think the essential point about the Sterling Act is it allowed the city to use wage taxes, which for most cities in America, that New York perhaps the exception, is really a rare tax base. Most of the time we use property taxes.
Now, there's an adage that goes something like this: you ought to tax what you don't want or what you can't move. This seems to be backwards of that calculus.
Yeah, it's exactly right. What you'd like to do from an efficiency point of view is tax things that can't move, that are here for purposes of providing a residency or a location for businesses.
And so toward that end, Holly, let's reintroduce that phrase, actual value initiative, AVI. It was very much in vogue for part of the Nutter administration. Now it's kind of on the back burner.
Well, I mean, one of Nutter's chief accomplishments, I think, is that he did end up revamping the property tax assessment system.
Which was sorely needed.
Totally broken. The assessments were very, very off in a way that overtaxed some people, undertaxed others. And Nutter came in and cleaned it up. It's not perfect today, but I'd say that's one of his biggest accomplishments in the tax policy realm. He came into office, I think, leading a lot of people to believe that he was a tax reformer. And in fact, in a lot of ways, he was. When he was a councilman, he fought John Street. He wanted to put on pause some wage tax reductions. Nutter insisted that he move forward with them and got together a council coalition and made that happen. Nutter also promised that he was going to do pretty drastic wage tax reductions, get them down to 3.25% for residents and non-residents by this year.
What is it currently?
It's now a little bit under 4%. So he has continued the wage tax reductions that have happened under past mayors, but not to the extent that he wanted to. And I think that's one of his biggest, I wouldn't say failures, maybe that's a little bit extreme, but he didn't get to where he wanted. And obviously, the Great Recession is a part of that.
But Bob, we are now several years out from the Great Recession. What are some of the other drags on the mayor being able to enact policy in
well,
that direction?
I totally agree with Holly's assessment of the AVI proposal. I think that's a major achievement for the city. From my point of view, the mayor made a tough call on the wage tax reduction, but it seems to me a necessary call given the fact that the city's finances were so tight. The real issue was, I think, credibly for the financial markets and for future residents, was is the budget going to be balanced? And on that dimension, I think he did a fine job. And the slowing of the wage tax cuts was certainly part of that policy agenda.
So one way to look at Nutter's legacy is to say that he came in promising these big tax reductions, and what we ended up getting was much slower wage tax cuts than he promised, a new cigarette tax, a sales tax increase that was supposed to be temporary and wasn't, as well as a number of tax proposals that didn't go through but that he tried, like a new soda tax, a higher liquor by the drink tax. The flip side of that is that he did weather us through the Great Recession. That was a huge accomplishment. And he also increased the local share of funding for the school district in a major, major way at the same time that the state share of funding went down.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm getting the sense from both of you that Mayor Nutter's efforts in this regard were well-intentioned but fell somewhat short. And it seems like Mayor-elect Kenney also has good intentions. What will it take, though, to execute whatever endeavor and path he wants to go down?
Well, I'll speak to the economics and I'll let Holly speak to the politics. I think the advantage that the mayor has is essentially a much stronger national economy in a way that Mayor Nutter did not have. And so I think and I'll go back to my earlier point, that the wider market is going to put a big premium on balanced budgets. I think it's going to be much easier to find the revenues needed to fund potentially new programs and stay and keep the budget within balance in this economic environment than it was ever possible for Mayor Nutter. I think the issue then becomes how you choose to spend the money, and that becomes a question, I suspect, that's going to be this balancing act between Kenny's priorities and perhaps council's priorities.
Council President Darrell Clark has shown himself to be someone who does not like to raise taxes, but is willing to do it when it comes to education and some of his other priorities. So I think Kenny is actually pretty similar in that way. He, of course, was on city council for many years. And again, I think that they start out with a good relationship. It's going to be tough to maintain that.
Bob, back to that city wage tax. What is a realistic goal? If it were back to, say, 1.5% back in, as it was in 1939, would that be okay? Or is the ultimate goal, idealistically, to eliminate it?
Well, eliminate it would mean that the only way you could maintain services is to find some alternative revenue source, which
as
means,
so many other metropolitan
yeah,
areas do.
And it really does mean ramming up the property tax to a significant degree. My realistic hope would be that the wage tax could get somewhere close to 3 or maybe a little bit below 3.
Both for residents and non-residents.
Yes.
Bob, Holly, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Robert Inman is professor of finance at Wharton. He's also a recent member of the Mayor's Task Force on Tax Policy. Holly Arterbein writes extensively about Philadelphia's tax structure, first for us at WHYY, and now at Philadelphia Magazine's Citified blog. And you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Turning to this evening's headlines, Pennsylvania lawmakers are sending a bill to the governor that would extend the Children's Health Insurance Program for 2 additional years, as well as move the program from the insurance department to the Department of Human Services. The House voted unanimously today to renew the program covering more than 150,000 residents who are not eligible for Medicaid. The change in state agencies is designed to save money and comply with federal regulations and should not affect eligibility, co-payments, benefits, or coverage. Governor Tom Wolf's spokesperson indicated that he will sign the bill. Henry Rowan passed away yesterday at the age of 92. He's the industrialist whose 1992 gift of $100 million to what was then Glassboro State College transformed the school and resulted in its being renamed in his honor. The gift to Glassboro State, now Rowan University, was at the time the largest ever given to a public college or university in the history of higher education. That's according to the school's website. 48 degrees, partly cloudy, it's 619. This evening's forecast, clouding up, low overnight, 43 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny, high 62. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY.
Newman University supports WHYY and encourages listeners who are looking to change life direction to discover the master's degree in pastoral clinical mental health counseling. The program can help prepare adults for professional licensure and roles in community counseling. Designed to integrate psychology and spirituality, this ecumenical program is open to people of all faith traditions. Details at newman.edu/WHYY. Newman University proudly supports WHYY.
The Williams Center for the Arts supports WHYY and proudly presents the only area performance of Patterson Joseph's Sancho, An Act of Remembrance, on December 14th. With large doses of wicked humor, Sancho tells the true story of the first black person of African origin to vote in Britain, the 18th century writer, composer, actor, and political wit Charles Ignatius. For tickets, williams-center.org or 610-330-5009.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The Phillies are trying to make the ballpark a little safer for fans next season. WHYY's Todd Bookman reports that the club is expanding the area behind home plate that's protected by netting.
This week, Major League Baseball released recommendations that stadiums extend the netting a full 70 feet in each direction. The move comes after several injuries suffered by fans last year, the result of hard-hit foul balls and broken bats.
That ball was smoked foul. How he's okay, I have no idea.
Did that ball hit that guy?
I think it did.
Mike Stiles is chief operating officer for the Phillies. He says the organization will extend netting right up to the near side of each dugout.
Major League Baseball studied it, and I think it's a reasonable balance between protecting our fans and still having a close connection to the game.
The new nets will protect about 400 to 500 more seats. Right now, about 700 seats are behind the screen. Stiles says the Phillies are looking to install thinner netting to make sure fans still have a good view of the game, and the organization plans more signs to remind people to pay attention. Pete Simcoe has season tickets for the Phillies on the first baseline. He's all for the new safety measures.
Every night, it seems like, you know, there's a stoppage in play because a fan was hit by a ball, and it's scary.
A report last year from Bloomberg News found that roughly 1,750 fans are injured by foul balls each season. That's slightly more than the number of batters hit by a pitch. The Phillies say they'll add more protective netting at the club's spring training facility as well. A class action lawsuit filed this summer by some Oakland A's fans calls on the league to extend the screen from foul pole to foul pole. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. Nearly half the homes in Pennsylvania are more than half a century old. Many lend character to neighborhoods, but others bring on problems like outdated amenities and extra maintenance. On tomorrow's show, we'll look at the implications of the aging housing stock in Pennsylvania cities. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The holiday gift that keeps on giving is a fund at the Philadelphia Foundation. You can support the arts, protect natural areas, promote health, provide scholarships, and help the needy, all while receiving tax benefits. The Foundation makes it easy to make a difference now and forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
As the older population continues to lead healthy and active lives, the communities that these people live in must adapt. AARP is helping communities adapt and respond to the needs of a rapidly aging population. Many cities are becoming age-friendly communities by adopting features such as safe, walkable streets, better housing and transportation options, and access to key services. More information and resources online at aarp.org/PA. AARP supports WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. For the first time, Yannick Nézet-Séguin conducts Handel's inspiring Messiah with the Philadelphia Orchestra, one of music's most powerful messages of faith. Messiah tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Yannick Nézet-Séguin, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and Handel's Messiah.